Welcome, everyone, to the Perceptive Podcast. I am Josh Beiser, and we got a great podcast for you tonight. My guest is from the developer Samurai Punk. He is the artist, level designer, and audio man behind their titles, including the recent game Screen Cheat. Please welcome to the cast, Nick McDonald.
Hi, nice to see you guys.
Hi, Nick. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Yeah. Thanks, thanks for letting me have you.
Yeah. So, to get things started with, for people who may not have heard of Screen Cheat or Samurai Punk, could you introduce yourself and a little bit about your studio?
Yeah, sure. So, I'm primarily the artist at Samurai Punk. We founded back in March of 2014, and now we're working on continuing development on Screen Cheat, which is our sort of first major title, which is a split-screen shooter where everyone is invisible and you have to screen cheat. Mm-hmm. And going forward, we're looking at building other games and continuing to support Screen Cheat as it goes on with its lifetime.
Okay. Now, for your studio, do you see your guys sticking with like the first-person shooter or online multiplayer games, or do you see yourself expanding into other genres?
I don't think we're particularly set in a genre. Like, the first game we made was a mobile game. The first game we released publicly as like a purchasable title was a mobile game. It was an infinite runner mashed up with Tetris. Before that, we jammed action games. We jammed narrative titles. I personally have a preference for first person, but I mean, I like to keep open and stay sort of able to build the best game I can, and that's not necessarily always a shooter or always a first person game.
Yep, definitely, and that's something we hear from a lot of indie developers, and probably one of the advantages of indie developers today is being able to keep that open mind. We've had developers on who just create such a wide variety of titles, both from their genres and just from their company itself, and you really don't see a lot of developers, at least from the indie market, get, you know, pigeonholed into just being, you know, the first-person shooter guys or the real-time strategy guys these days.
Yeah, I think it's because we're just not limited by sort of investors who would tell us, well, you've been successful here, you've proven it, there's money in this area, so why don't you just keep making this, right? So we can kind of do what we want and do what feels right, and the advantage is that we always are passionate about what we're working on, and we always have this sort of creative freedom to experiment with things that haven't been done or experiment with things that have been done but do it in a more interesting way or a more challenging way.
Yep. Now, you said a few seconds ago that you like first-person shooters and online games like that. Are there any other genres that you like to play in your spare time?
I play an absolute load of genres. The only thing I really don't play is sports games, personally. I am really big into roguelikes, especially roguelites, like games that have a slightly more casual approach to it. I mean, I have tried NetHack and I have tried Rogue as well, but they're just far too impenetrable for me, where I enjoy that sort of procedural content in games.
Yeah, and you definitely picked the right guy to talk to about roguelikes. I've been on a roguelike spree myself. Been playing The Binding of Isaac. Friend gifted me Nuclear Throne, which I've been enjoying.
Yeah, those are both fantastic. And the thing is, all the really good roguelikes we're seeing are all independent games because it's really good for production and you can create a lot of content very easily. Or not easily, but it gives you the ability to produce a lot of content. I should never say that's easy to do. And they are able to put all so much polish into it, and you get these really finely tuned games that are just wealths of gameplay as well.
Yeah, and you don't need to go, you know, overboard in terms of like graphics and presentation. Like, you don't need millions of dollars to create a really good roguelike. If you can build a really strong foundation, like we saw with Isaac, FTL, and etc., the game just becomes so much greater than the sum of its parts that way.
Yeah, exactly.
And I guess for me, in terms of genres that I don't like, I'm also with you. I'm not a huge sports fan myself. I could never get into, like, simulator games, you know, like car driving, airplane, stuff like that.
I mean, personally, the only simulators I've been into or tried excessively is MilSims, but maybe that's just because it bleeds back into the shooter area where I play a fair bit of Armor, but that is a combined operations simulator. And it's about the experience of being in a cog in a machine with a large force of military.
Yeah.
It's not the experience of being a soldier on the front lines as much. But I think that's just an interesting experience, but that might just be the interest of a large community-driven multiplayer game as well.
Now, getting back to Screen Cheat, I was trying this out earlier, and the idea is pretty interesting in terms of the fact that you're, as you say, you're essentially having to look at the other player's screens in order to figure out where they are and what's going on, and that definitely requires a different type of level and weapon design compared to a traditional first-person shooter. In terms of, well, let's start with weapon balance. In terms of that, how did you guys approach that looking at, you know, this unique concept?
Well, we kind of knew for a start that all the guns were going to have very lenient hitboxes or very lenient spreads. Mm-hmm. And it all started back in January when we jammed the game and we had an original prototype. We only had one gun, which was the Blunderbuss, the gun that's still in it, only ever received one or maybe two modifications through its entire lifetime. And our sort of approach mm-hmm. for balance was to bring every gun up to that level of power,
yeah.
as well as get every gun to that level of simplicity of use, because it is meant to be a pick up and play couch game, or like a game you play with your friends. Not like it's not meant to be a incredibly competitive, you know, 300-hour mm-hmm. shooter.
Yeah.
So after that point, we kind of knew how easy a gun had to be to use, because the mechanic is so daunting at first. The gun needs to sort of do a lot of work for you.
Mm-hmm.
And then beyond that, we started looking at ways we could bring variety to our guns, because we couldn't do traditional shooter gun designs. Like, you can't do a rifle, an automatic weapon in our game. Mm-hmm. You can't do...
like a sniper rifle either.
Yeah, you can't do high precision weapons, and you can't do high rate of fire weapons or high spread. So you mm-hmm. couldn't do a flamethrower, but you can get away with a shotgun. And the reason for that is because experimenting with high rates of fire, the guns are very unsatisfying to use mm-hmm. the more bullets you shoot. But if you shoot two shots and you kill one enemy, it's a lot better if you shoot one shot and you kill one enemy, right? Like, so mm-hmm. the because the experience is more about thinking and determining placement in space mm-hmm. of the opponent, when you have guns where you are forced to sort of think through each shot, which mm-hmm. is encouraged by these slow fire weapons, we found that worked a lot better. And that really pushed the direction of all the guns.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said before, variety was really important to us. So we've got this set of limitations, which we are well aware of, which is, you know, a design that has a sort of set of weapons it can have. So now we have to try and build variety within that set. Mm-hmm. And you get things like, I guess the more abstract weapons would be the Chevrolet, which is a charge weapon. It charges a big ball of energy, and that's quite like a very generous ball, and it bounces around. And we're also able to use weapons to play on the mechanic of screen cheating by revealing player position with the weapon.
Mm-hmm.
So if, for example, a weapon is too powerful, you can bring its power level down by having it have a slow time to charge up, and it reveals position as it charges, like the Chef does,
mm-hmm.
Which is another sort of thing we're able to do that you wouldn't normally be able to do in another shooter, where visibility is implicit in a normal shooter. It's not in ours. So that is actually mm-hmm. something we're able to play with. And you can use it as a scaling factor for difficulty or for balance, or you can use it for purely a mechanic sense.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have sort of other strange guns that take advantage of the fact that you always have permanent information of your opponents, for example. So the crossbow is a sort of standard point-shoot crossbow, like I'd say the bolt gun. Half-Life 2 bolt crossbow. It mm-hmm. shoots, it pins to the wall. It's a very precise weapon, but what it does is it connects to you a laser wire for a mm-hmm. limited amount of time, and anything that touches that laser wire dies.
Okay.
And if I hadn't said it before, all our guns are one-shot kills. And that mm-hmm. was also explained by the screen sheet mechanic kind of requiring that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so this tripwire in any other game would kind of be kind of crap, because you don't really know if an opponent's going to walk around a corner, but in screen sheet, you can know if an opponent is going to walk around a corner.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a weapon that at first would seem underpowered, and then as you start to use it, you would be like, okay, if I place it against this corner, right as the opponent comes around it, or just before the opponent comes around it, he won't have time to react,
mm-hmm.
and he'll get trapped, or I can use it to zone control him and push him into a different area. So it's really interesting designing guns for this game, because you can do such interesting things with it mechanically.
Yeah, but as you said a few seconds ago regarding being limited in a sense from a traditional first-person shooter, you know, from high rate of fire, high precision, it
yeah.
really does give screen cheat a different feel to it, because you have to think a little bit more tactically compared to a traditional first-person shooter, where it is more about reaction timing, you know, quick reflexes. We see this a lot in, you know, if you watch Call of Duty or high-level play like that,
yeah.
where it's more about, you know, keeping yourself as mobile as you can. There's no time to really stop and, you know, think about what's going on. But
yeah.
with your game and how it's more about, you know, that one shot, you have to get that one perfect impact in order to win, it does give itself a very unique flow to it.
Yeah. I think that also, it must just come down to the mechanic, right? So we're forcing players to play in a methodical way where positioning matters so much more than it ever would before.
Because
mm-hmm. you can be in it. We've played so many games. Right? I've played like 500 hours of the game. And you start walking up a ramp, and you can see 5 seconds before you get up that ramp that if I move up this point, I'm dead, because my opponent has already got his gun pointing there.
Mm-hmm.
And I can assume he's probably waiting for me to get up that ramp because he's waiting for an easy shot, right?
Yeah.
So you can start to get like the highest levels of play go beyond screen cheating and go into the point of mind games where you have to start faking out your movements, forcing your opponent to make a counter movement, and then flanking that movement.
Yeah, but all the while that they're able to look at your viewpoint and you're able to look at theirs.
Yes, you're actually able to provide them some sort of false information. It's quite hard, but it's really interesting when it does occur, and it's causes it's just really interesting gameplay that I've never really done before or seen before.
Now, another part of screen cheat has to be the level design, because part of the game is, as we said, being able to read what your opponent's looking at and seeing where that is in relation to what you're looking at. So, in terms of developing the levels, how does that differ in screen cheat from a traditional first-person shooter?
Well, I mean, that was the biggest challenge of screen cheat, was from the start getting levels that were sort of comprehensible and readable to the sort of average player. And that came down to sort of creating an economy of information where I would sort of talk in a macro, mini, and micro sense. So the macro information that you present to the player is the colored regions. So all the maps are broken down into quadrants of color. And if a player glances at someone's screen, they can say, yes, he is in, or they're in this point of the map. They're in this quadrant because they're in red, right? That's that's one quarter of the information already processed in their brain just because of color. And the brain is really good at reading colors. And then beyond that, we use structural information. So he's in red around this corner, maybe within a 5 meter radius. And you've already narrowed that down even more. And then beyond that, I use smaller details like large detail assets. They're still large assets. They're maybe a meter by a meter in size, but they are sort of like unique assets that are in particular positions that will give away a position, say a painting or a statue or a railing or a flag or something, right? And these sort of help you break down that information in a fast way. And I use this method consistently throughout all my level designs with the hopes that people will start, and it seems to be working, where people are able to sort of understand the logic and break it down as quickly as possible. And at first glance, most players will understand the first two parts of that level, where that they always know color and then structure. Like, they can always get that position fairly close. And then if you really want to be precise, then you have time to go for the micro. And on top of that, we obviously, a lot of the weapons give away positions, so that's able to sort of help players fight back against a better player. So a real flaw originally, before we sort of solved it, was that players who had more knowledge of a map were significantly better than players who don't, which in a normal shooter is true, but this is exacerbated by the screen cheating mechanic where knowledge of the map is actually ability to play. So by giving players secondary information that isn't map-based, they were still able to fight back while they sort of started to learn the map.
Okay. And I just want to clarify this next point for the people listening. When you're looking at the other player's screens, are you able to see, like, their weapon, like, in the environment, or you can only see, like, the after effect, like, if someone shoots a gun?
Yeah, you can see, if you are seeing their screen, you see their gun on their screen, so you know what gun they're using. But outside of that, on your, so in your quadrant of the screen, you can only see the effects of their guns. So if they shoot a blunderbuss, that leaves a smoke trail. And you can see the point of origin of that smoke trail, and that's very important. And or you can see the ball of energy charging up on the Chevrolet, or you can see the origin point of the crossbow, or the fire trail that gets left behind by the hobby horse.
Okay. Now, another part of screen cheat will be the game modes. I know you guys have multiple game modes to play the game in. So could you go into a little bit more detail about what type of gameplay people will have access to in screen cheat?
Yeah, sure. So there's a couple of sort of standard game modes. We've got Deathmatch, King of the Hill, One Shot, Murder Mystery, and Elimination currently, as well as just the Party mode, which lets you just shuffle through all the modes. So everyone sort of knows how King of the Hill and Deathmatch work, but we obviously, just by putting screen cheating, the screen cheating layer onto it, the King of the Hill is just plays very differently to most shooters, where you have players constantly aware of position, and you get hills being this completely contested area where you need to defend it, but defending a hill is much easier when you're, you know, visible. You can always know which directions your opponents are coming from. So if it's one versus three and you're on the hill and they're all further away, you can sort of try to stop them from getting up there. But obviously you've got three people coming. So it's actually possible to perfectly defend a hill, except we expose the hill so much that the players are incredibly open when they're on there. So it's this really fast and really frantic mode. It's not meant to be competitive. It's meant to be fun. Deathmatch is a really good way to warm up, and it's probably one of the sort of generally better modes. We have One Shot, which is a mode we introduced fairly on, which is harder. It is everyone gets one bullet until everyone reloads or 15 seconds expires. This only works for 6 of the 8 guns currently in the game, unfortunately. But so everyone gets the same gun, and they have to basically play a mode where they are forced to think through their shots. And what we found, mostly from a development side, is that we really sort of, once we added this mode, we really understood how the game worked, because we could see that this mode, one play effectively, is one of the most satisfying modes, because getting that shot and knowing you only have one is even more powerful than when you just have to take a long time to reload.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, really, it's also very, very challenging. So it's more of an expert level mode.
Yep. Now, in terms of, like, content progression, does Screen Cheat have, like, any progression models? Like, we could talk about Call of Duty's whole, you know, experience-based stuff like that. Like, is there anything that players can unlock or get access to through play?
Outside of achievements, no.
Okay.
Basically, there are really challenging achievements we have in the game. Mm-hmm. But outside of that, no, there's no progression. We wanted this to be a game. You sit down, you have all the content. Like Smash Brothers, you basically have nearly everything. Like, mm-hmm. we've described it as the Mario Party or the Mario Kart of shooters before.
Cool.
So the approach is for a lighter experience than a heavier experience, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Now, another part that's interesting is that the game is limited to 4-player matches. Now, was this due to, like, limitations of the screen, or was this sort of like a balancing decision made when you guys first started?
A little bit of both, and also on performance a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Though we have been experimenting with an 8-player setup, or a 4-to-8-player setup with scaling space. But once you get beyond 4 players, the game, the experience is fundamentally very different. Mm-hmm. We find, you know, if you play a 2-player game versus a 4-player game, you're going from this very calculated 1-versus-1
mm-hmm.
mind-reading game to a sort of a faster, more frantic game in 4 players. And when you get to 8, it's a complete mess, but it's a fantastically fun mess.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at trying to get an 8-player mode in, but it was never a design limitation outside of the fact that it's every different stage of sort of scaling of players is a fundamentally different experience.
Yeah.
Limiting it to 8 would probably be the absolute maximum, because beyond that, it would be an impossible game to play, and it wouldn't really be Screen Cheat anymore. You'd basically be just shooting in the wind and hoping to get kills.
Yeah.
One thing I didn't mention about the maps is that they're tiny.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the maps are absolutely tiny. So with 16 players, you could basically shoot and not miss anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as you said, when you start adding in more players, that extends the design. It will have to require different balance. Because when you start having, you know, 8 players, 6 players, stuff like that, as you said, if your levels are small, you need to expand them out. But then at the same time, you also have to change how the weapons work. And it just becomes, you know, an ever-escalating amount of complexity.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's why I said, like, it becomes frantic because you miss less and your targets are the person, like, you kind of get into these really nice situations where in a 4-player game, you would kind of, like, you have a target and you kind of know who is trying to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And you're chasing one guy while trying to not get chased by the other guy. But in an 8-player game, that kind of goes out of the window, which isn't great. But we have had really good experiences with it. So it's definitely something we're looking at. There's also a performance concern, because when you render 8 cameras, it's 8 times more expensive on the GPU.
Yeah.
But our game is very lightweight in lots of ways. One of those ways is graphically. It's very, very efficient, and it's quite possible to do it. So we've just got to do a little bit more optimization and then fix it up.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of developing the game further, right now, Screen Cheat is officially out, right? It's not in early access or anything like that.
Yeah, it officially launched in October last year, or end of October.
And what are you guys doing in terms of, like, post-release support? Now, we just talked a little bit about the 8-player multiplayer as a possibility, but do you guys see yourselves continually to expand on Screen Cheat?
Yeah, even since release, we've already started releasing new content. We've put out, we did a map game mode. We did a lot of usability upgrades and features, and we did some optimizations and fixes. But we kind of have like a couple of months of development still planned in.
Mm-hmm.
We want to try and increase the content and really give you a valued experience, like a really good amount of content. There's at least one more gun coming, which is on the way. And I've live streamed that, and it's been going really well. A couple more maps, modes, and there's some fairly major online user end experience stuff that we want to fix up.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking at fixing up going forward before we sort of call the game done.
All right. Now, one part that I find interesting is that, of course, Screen Cheat is available on Steam and has been fully integrated to Steam. And this is something that I haven't talked to too many developers about. And I was just wondering, from a development standpoint, how has Steam sort of helped with Screen Cheat's development?
I haven't really heard any other developers really say this before, but, like, for us, working through Steam, we got Steam fairly early in development. I think we started properly in development in March, and we got Steam in, like, maybe late April, maybe a little bit late, maybe early May or mid-May. We finished in October, so we had about 6 months where we were sort of on Steam during development. Mm-hmm. And it was a fantastic, more than just a publishing tool, but a fantastic development tool for us. Because we worked remotely for the bulk of our project. Like, we only moved into our office like 5 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to, for example, make a build on my end, upload it in a couple of minutes, which is good for Australian internet,
mm-hmm.
Because we have unanimously terrible internet here. And I was able to upload a build, only updates the difference of the build, so it doesn't update the entire thing. So our games are about 500 meg. So if you're uploading an entire build, that can take a long time on our internet. But mm-hmm. if it's only updating the difference, that's somewhere between, you know, 10 to 80 meg.
Yeah.
So it's much faster. So for one, the build is online really quick. Then I can give access through beta keys to people I need to help test the game because it's online.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a lot of online problems during development. We are able to get testers very easily because I can say, here's a key. You now have access to the game. And then I say, oh, there's new patches up. Just verify your cache, download the changes, and we can play in, you know, maybe an hour's turnaround time, as opposed to an old method we used to use before we had Steam, which was uploading builds to Dropbox. This mm-hmm. is when the game was small, too. This is when the game was about 200 meg or less.
Mm-hmm.
And it would take hours. So,
yeah, and that's another really good point about sort of how Steam has really changed things in terms of just how more accessible it is compared to the old days. You were just mentioning about Dropbox. I remember the days where you had to, you know, hunt down game patches, like developer wouldn't have on their website. You would have to find a third party hosting, hopefully get a good mirror for the server. And even then, you know, who knows if you're able to get the patch, and then you have to repeat the same process for every, you know, little incremental update. And today, as you said, it's go on Steam, let it update, in, you know, 5-10 minutes, you can play the game again.
Yeah, I think it's a generally positive change.
Mm-hmm.
There is, like, some downsides to it, is the general community in at large treats mm-hmm. the game, or treats games as a service, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And this is like, that used to be a thing you think of when you talk about like an MMO or when you talk about a large multiplayer game by AAA, but now even small games are sort of looked at like a service,
mm-hmm.
which means that there's an expectation of patches and content and support. Now, that's understandable, but that's a lot of expectation. So if you scope correctly and if you plan correctly and you build your game and you could have it finished in however amount of time it takes to finish a game and you release it, but then, and you say, well, this is done, we're happy with it, it's actually it's as bug-free as we can get it, and it mm-hmm. runs smooth, there might still be this expectation from the community to do patches and support the game beyond the release, and you're like, well, I've already provided you my product, but you want me to provide a service,
mm-hmm.
Which is some downside, but I think overall it's still fairly positive.
Yeah, and that's another really good debate we've heard from a lot of developers and a lot of consumers since Steam really blew up in terms of video game notoriety. And even more so with how early access, Kickstarter, and crowdfunding have become sort of, you know, the buzz trends of the last 2 years. And how consumers, when they see a game on early access or they see a game on Steam, they are not thinking so much in terms of what they buy now. They want to know, you know, what's coming 6 months? Are you guys going to keep supporting it? What's your DLC lineup going to be like? Et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And last week I spoke with Zach Barth, who does Space Chem, and he's going to be releasing his next game, Infinifactory, on early access. And he talked about a little bit more in terms of what he's calling, he wants to make his game a living game, quote unquote, where it's going to be released and then he's going to sort of let the community decide how far he goes with it. And as you said, Nick, that sort of lends itself into the games as a service because he's going to keep providing support as long as people keep paying for it. But as you were also saying, a lot of games really aren't developed for that, you know, long-term development. Some games really are, you know, maybe a 5-10 hour experience, or, you know, the game is done and we want to move on to something else.
Yeah. I mean, it also comes down to parts of how you position your product when you release it. So we, you know, we are a online product. It's online multiplayer and local multiplayer.
Mm-hmm.
But that kind of comes with a precedent that most other online games have, is that usually there's content support down the line, whether or not it be free or paid. Mm-hmm. And you know, we put ourselves in that position, even though we sort of always planned the game as a fairly small experience.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's interesting. I'm not sure how I feel about it exactly. I mean, this is a product that we want to support because we have a community and we want to make sure that community grows
mm-hmm.
and that people get a good product, right? And we, you know, didn't have a perfect launch. There were bugs in the game and we need to keep fixing those and we need to And we found since its release that there's a lot of features that we want to fix or add. So we personally as creative people want to continue working on it. But there's risk that you sort of as a creative person are now sort of stuck continuing on a product. Even if you say the developer of Spacecam is continuing on development until the community says so, but maybe what if that goes on for 3 years, but he only really has it in him to do it for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what does he say to his community? Then he says, oh, well, I'm done with this. I want to move on to something different.
Mm-hmm.
Does he stop?
Yeah. And it's definitely a very murky issue because we've seen examples of how it has succeeded with developers, sort of like Prison Architect from Introversion. And then we've seen it, you know, outright crash, such as with Space-Based DF9. From yep. Double Fine, where they said they were basically banking on getting 5 years of development funding from the game through early access, and they just completely miscalculated, and now the game is sort of left in the state where they don't have the funding to support it, but the game is, you know, nowhere near what they promised and what the consumer is expecting from them.
Yeah, there's also that financial end to it, which we can't predict. Fortunately, we have a plan for how much more content we're producing, and that's based on what we can afford to do. And it's also partially what we can creatively afford to do. So we're at a point where we're kind of ready to move on, but we also know that we want to improve what we have. So. Yeah.
And I just want to clarify this point for the people listening. You said that ScreenTree, of course, has online play. Does it have servers, or is it basically direct IP to the different players?
It's using a service called Photon, which is basically a peer-to-peer network.
Okay. One final question that I have for you, Nick, about ScreenCheat would be the actual art design or the aesthetic for the game. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how you develop essentially the look of ScreenCheat.
Yeah, sure. So the look kind of came about for two reasons. The reason it looks the way it does is two part. Mm-hmm. The first part is that the game has four screens, and we always knew that we needed this game to run fast because I refuse to play a game less than 60 frames.
Mm-hmm.
And I would rather play it at 120, but I can't always. So, like, okay, we need a performative art style, right? And it has to run fast on low-spec machines because we like supporting as many platforms as possible and as many people as possible. Like, you know, some people have old hardware.
Mm-hmm.
And it had to... And the disadvantage of playing a split-screen game is you have four screens, four cameras. I mentioned before, that means four times the draw calls and four times the amount of work on the GPU.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really expensive, right? And, you know, the look of modern games is created because it uses expensive shaders, it uses high detail textures, it uses high resolution models, and that's how you get that sort of nice, clean, shiny look. So what we did was we stripped all that back, and we used legacy shaders. Like, the bulk of all the shaders in our game are using flat, plain, blend diffuse. And I basically went aggressively and said, what can I do with this optimized shader, right? Like, mm-hmm. What can I do with this? And I basically found a way to create this pseudo cel-shaded look. I've heard it described as that before. It was never intentional at first, but it sort of kind of went from there. And I had, you know, with the art, as well as the, like, high color palette. So it's very colorful. Everything is textured. Like, that was very important to me. Like, everything's very strong structural shapes, textured. And I was trying to figure out how I can make this all sort of come together and not look like disingenuous and not look like weird sci-fi.
Because
it was just going to be a mishmash of things. And I found an architecture style from the 1800s called the Neoclassical Revival, which was popular in Western Europe and Eastern Europe to some extent. And it kind of gave me sort of like a very loose time period to work with aesthetically. It gave me an architecture style that I could use for my buildings. And you create these interior and exterior spaces like mansions, museums, ruined buildings, or you can have dining halls. And it fits if you have a colored region in one part of the building and there's textures on the wall that like are different from other parts of the wall because it's just different wallpaper. And since you're changing the color, it kind of makes sense for the eye. And that's where I came about sort of building this sort of like old but colorful look that was super clean and super optimized. And it's always been a fight in the game between making things look better versus making things run better.
Yeah. Besides, like, the shader itself sort of giving it that, as you said, like, that faux cel-shaded look, did you have any, like, inspirations or art style designs that sort of inspired you when you were creating ScreenCheat?
Not explicit art styles. Like I said, I was inspired by this architecture style I found. And I was also looking at Mario Kart, the battle mode a lot for the when I was looking at level design. I was just looking at how they approach that, and I was looking at older games and how they approach their texturing and how they made really flat texturing not look shit.
Mm-hmm.
And everything, I mean, like, the lighting in the game is very flat and very matte. It's like a matte finish.
Mm-hmm.
And we use really aggressive ambient occlusion to give it this sort of, like, stark contrast between the different layers. And, yeah, there was no real point of inspiration out for, like, particularly for the art style, other than just, like, a look I wanted to create and had to create for myself because I'd never seen it in a game. So I had to attempt to create this sort of, like, flat matte finish that was colorful and represented what I wanted it to represent as much as I could because I was very limited by performance and that I could create the assets and build environments out of it. And there was also, it also came down a lot to the fact that everything, I gray box my levels in a form that I would call my color box levels. So most games gray box their levels by like building in the rough structures. They're all gray and everything. So when I test my levels, I build them in color regions. And it sort of naturally builds this sort of like slightly abstract appearance of a building. And then I go into actually building out the building from that space.
Cool. Just trying to think if there's any other questions. Are there any other parts of Screen Sheet that we haven't mentioned yet that you want me to bring up?
Not really. The game is, like I said, it's a fairly compact experience, and we've basically gone over the main points.
All right. In that case, let's move on and talk a little bit more about online multiplayer and sort of how it has expanded the years. I know on the Screen Sheet site, you guys talked about sort of paying homage to the classic local multiplayer games like GoldenEye, Perfect Dark, etc.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting to see how multiplayer has sort of grown. We were talking about this before the cast and sort of how it has the resurgence of it for competitive and cooperative play. And as we were talking about before the cast, for pretty much the last decade, multiplayer was sort of dominated by the MMO market, World of Warcraft, EverQuest, etc. And it really wasn't really set up for local or, you know, small groups of people playing. And I guess from what I was looking at, some of like the big games that sort of brought multiplayer back would be like Halo, even Team Fortress. The game that really got me back into multiplayer, I think, would probably be Left 4 Dead from Valve. And that was like 2007, maybe 2008, I think.
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do with, well, there's shifts, obviously, back and forth between where the main group of people playing online is. But I think it had a lot to do with that switch from consoles being a local experience to being an online experience. And to some extent, that's also negatively affected the modern console generation, where they've completely disregarded the concept of local multiplayer.
Yeah.
Except for like a Wii U, which is all about that, right? So, you know, with like Halo 2, I think, was one of the first Xbox original games that had local multiplayer. Sorry, had online multiplayer. And that was my sort of upbringing for games, started with landing Red Alert 2 on PC and then moving to a console and playing Halo and then playing Halo 2 online. So for me, I kind of saw that trend as it moved, as consoles moved away from local multiplayer and towards online, and it sort of reached a more mass audience. Whereas before, you, like you said, it was basically exclusively MMOs and competitive shooters like Quake, like arena shooters.
Yeah,
and then some RTSs had peer-to-peer, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of dominated by competitive games, and now it's competitive casual, which is very strange.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I still remember my first big multiplayer experience was pretty much a LAN Halo 1 party at a guy's house. We basically took like four Xboxes and jerry-rigged them around the house so we could all play together for like a night of just constantly killing each other.
Yeah.
And I think another part of how multiplayer has sort of grown over the last decade would be the changing of the internet technologies. I still remember the days of dial-up modems and the horror that entails when you're trying to play online with like a 16 kilobyte modem and, you know, someone picks up the phone, you lose connection. And pretty much cable modems or DSL lines really became big over the last decade, or probably a little bit before that. I know I didn't get my first cable modem until I think it was like early thousands when I finally got a cable modem. It was like a glorious moment when I realized I could be online and someone could use the phone and nothing would break apart because of it.
Yeah. Like, the internet's fast enough now that you can have like a reliable like 10-person game on a peer-to-peer network, which is kind of crazy. When back, I mean, like early 2000s, to play a PC game, it would have to be on a dedicated server or a local server, right?
Yeah. And even then, for most developers, there wasn't, like, a standard, like, online community. Like, we just talked about Steam a few minutes ago and how it's made things really accessible. But, in, you know, for, like, the first half of 2000, developers pretty much had to rely on third parties such as GameSpy in order to have multiplayer connectivity, because the developers themselves couldn't really have the funding or the hardware to support, you know, massive online communities unless you went, you know, the full-blown EverQuest World of Warcraft route.
Yeah, exactly. And now we're in the days where you can see a game like Due Process come out, and that's made by a tiny little team, and it's fantastic.
And with the multiplayer as well, it's no longer limited to these massive games. We have a lot of developers go like the experimental route. I remember this game called The Ship that came out 2 years ago.
Oh my god, The Ship. Yeah. We actually, I didn't bring it up effectively, but there was a game mode in Screensheet called Murder Mystery, which is heavily inspired by The Ship, where you find your targets based on a card you get, and it says your target is in this part of the ship of the map, and you need to figure out who their target is and then kill them for points.
Mm-hmm.
But The Ship, that was a fantastic experience, and that was quite a while ago as well.
Yeah, and I know one developer that I'm following, Chris Hecker, who's doing Spy Party at the moment, which is sort of another very unique multiplayer concept where one player has to pretend to be an AI at a party while the other guy's a sniper who has to figure out who's the player. And it's like a game of wits. And as we talked about with Screensheet, and in terms of, you know, extrapolating multiplayer out, when you're down to just two players, a one-on-one match, it becomes such a very, you know, tactical, very strategic affair. It's a lot of sort of like that same experience we see in fighting games, and, you know, the interplay of two master-level fighting game players.
Yeah, it kind of simulates the same sort of things that were going on in your head, where it stops being about the mechanics of the game and more goes on to the thought processes of your opponent and try to predict what your opponent's doing to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Now, are there any other, like, online shooters or just online multiplayer games in general that you like to play in your spare time?
I think I mentioned it before. Arma 3 was really big for me this year. Counter-Strike GO, Killing Floor. Those are basically what I've been playing the last couple of years. Payday 2 was big for a while, though it got quiet because that game's had a weird history for development.
Yeah.
And has problems, and then it got less problems, and it got better and got worse. It's a strange game.
Yeah.
Yeah, I tend to vote for, like, cooperative online shooters. The first thing that actually really got me into PC gaming was Left 4 Dead 1, actually. That was the first time I'd ever downloaded Steam, and I played. Some friends at high school told me about it, and they're like, oh, there's this game, but you have to use Steam. I'm like, what the hell's Steam?
I do not
regret that decision. This is back, I think, sort of at the early days of Steam when it barely had a store. It was probably a couple of years in at that point, but
yeah,
you know, people were still disgruntled that you had to use Steam for every Valve game. They were very upset.
Yeah. I mean, I've said this story on the cast multiple times. I got Steam when it was required for Half-Life 2 in 2004. I hated it. I uninstalled after finishing the game, never looked at it again. And then, like, in 2007, 2008, when the Orange Box came out, my parents were like, you gotta download this. You need Team Fortress. Like, do I really want Steam? And they're like, yes, download it. And then never went away after that. Now I have, like, 700-800 games on Steam. And, again, as you were saying, Nick, it's such a huge switch from, you know, the early part of the last decade to the end of the last decade in terms of PC games and just the industry in general. I mean, how many times did I read or we all saw those posts where people saying, you know, PC gaming's dead, consoles are the future, you're never going to need a computer again because you have Xbox. And now, you know, we're hearing stories of Valve going to take Steam and try to bring it into the console market with the Steam Box. PC gaming is huge. I mean, the whole indie market has just, you know, grown immensely thanks to Steam and thanks to its accessibility and for all the reasons we've talked about with Screensheet.
Yeah, it's a bit of a switch, I could say, especially because that switch happened during my sort of early development years as a sort of a gamer or playing games and then going into making them. And it was really cool to see. And sort of exciting because it's like, oh, from having no opportunities, I now have opportunities. Where the first sort of word I heard about the concept of an indie developer was Dishwasher the Dead Samurai for Xbox 360. It was sort of the first times I'd heard about indie developers. This might have been back in, this is a while ago actually, this would be 2005 or 2006. And then you know, I was sort of becoming aware that you can make games. Like, how do I distribute them? Xbox is such a hard thing to penetrate.
Mm.
And then you're like, well, Steam. And then there's this Meat Boy game came out, right?
Yeah.
So it's the transparency of distribution platforms, which is kind of killing publishers, which is kind of funny.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're looking at the AAA market over the last 2-3 years. It's really taking a hit thanks to both, like, Steam sales and just the sheer volume of games that are being released. This is another topic we've talked about in the past, but, I mean, in the old days, you know, 90s and early 2000s, you would maybe buy one game, and that would be it for, like, a month or several weeks. Now, today, you buy a game, and chances are there's going to be 15, 20 games coming out the very next day. And we're just being flooded with titles of varying quality. I mean, we've seen some amazing indie games, we've seen some craptacular AAA games, and vice versa.
Yeah, it's just kind of like exposing you to all what was... There's a lot of that was going on beforehand, which is kind of cool to know. Like, if you sort of look back... There was a fair amount of these games before. You remember, but like before Greenlight, everyone was like, "Oh, yeah, there's not that many PC games coming out." But mm-hmm. you go through this sort of the dark web of indie games, and there was a lot of these games being made, and now they're sort of being exposed to the general audience,
mm-hmm.
which is actually great because it means that the good games in this pile of poo can get mm-hmm. found, and it's fantastic. And mm-hmm. you know, the shit games still get seen as shit, except that people see them now.
Yeah,
it's cool to know just how much quality is being made.
Mm-hmm. Now, since we are on the subject of Steam, Nick, I want to get your thoughts on a opinion that we hear from a lot of developers, and one of the, I guess, criticisms that people have about Steam, and how a lot of people view it as being too popular. It's too much of a golden ticket for game developers, in the sense that if you can't get on Steam, you're going to be climbing such an uphill battle compared to someone who can get on Steam and have all the resources and accessibility available to it.
Yeah, it's an interesting discussion, actually, because
mm-hmm.
Steam dominates the market as far as sales go, right?
Mm-hmm.
It also has very good tools for distribution, and it has very good tools for development, and it has good tools for marketing. Like, this isn't the day when you get on Steam and you make a million anymore, right? We all know that's long gone,
mm-hmm.
but it's still a very powerful tool, and it is kind of, if you say you're making a PC game, it's kind of if you tell the consumer that, they kind of assume you're on Steam.
Mm-hmm.
Because if someone plays games on their PC and they're not playing an MMO, they're probably used to getting them through Steam, which is kind of upsetting, because there isn't a competitor to it. And I think that's the main problem. Like, Origin and Ubisoft and Uplay can do whatever they want, but they're never going to compete with Steam because they're terrible, terrible.
Yes.
Like, they're terrible, like, platforms.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not open platforms either. They're not even, like, Steam is not an open platform by any sense, but it's not letting people get on there. So, yeah, it's not great. Fortunately, Steam is pushing towards being more open, which makes it better for new developers who don't have contacts at Steam or don't have a way to get on there other than through Greenlight, which is a terrible process, as we all know.
Mm-hmm.
But there does need to be a genuine competitor.
Yeah.
And that's... It's not Steam's fault. It was just the first to the race, and it did really well, right? Mm-hmm. But no one caught on quick enough. And the people that did catch on didn't try to compete. They just tried to do their own thing,
mm-hmm.
right? So you see Humble doesn't really compete, and GOG doesn't really compete. Those are the other two major platforms.
Yeah.
Humble sells cheap games. That's what it is known for. And GOG sells old games. Mm-hmm. That's what it's known for currently. Those things might change in the future, but mm-hmm. at this point, there's no real competitor. And
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with it if there was, but there is no competition, and you kind of need to be on that platform.
Yeah, and it's the similar parallel to the MMO market and what happened with World of Warcraft, and how it basically, well, we could argue it still is the dominant MMO of the, I think it came out in 2004, I believe, or maybe even a little bit earlier.
They just celebrated their 10-year anniversary.
I mean, that is insane. I mean, Steam, I think, just celebrated their 10-year anniversary as well last year. So, I mean, it's insane to have these platforms and these games that last 10 years. But as we were just talking about, in terms of competition, there's no one who can really get close to them. With World of Warcraft, the MMO market took a huge hit because everyone was trying to copy WoW instead of trying to be better than them.
Yeah.
And the same thing with Steam. I mean, we were just talking about Uplay and Origin. I mean, neither one of those services have done anything remarkable, or they can't boast anything that they do better than Steam. And it's not, as we said, it's not Valve's fault. They made a really, really great product. But there's just no one who's trying to compete with them. And the better question is, could anyone actually compete with Steam at this point?
Steam is not a perfect product, though.
Yeah.
It's good, and it has been great. And it has its ups and downs of when it's like, it gets better and then it gets worse because it sort of gets outdated and then they patch it and it gets better. Mm-hmm. But I think it's possible for someone to compete with it for sure from a sort of a usability standpoint when it comes to consumers, mm-hmm. from a curation standpoint, and from a developer standpoint. There are all things that can be improved in all of those areas, and someone could make an outright better product. Whether or not they could attempt to even get into the market, I don't mm-hmm. know.
Yeah.
We've heard rumors that GOG are attempting to do something with Good Old Games Galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
They do have a chunk of the market, so that at least they're not going to go in blind, but it's interesting. It might take, it might actually take Steam having like a crash and just like, you know, because it's so big, it just sort of bursts its own bubble.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and say, it might take something like that where someone gets an opportunity to come in, but mm-hmm. it's kind of like a perfect storm, right? It might not happen. So,
yep.
it's an interesting question that you really can't answer. You could try to just watch.
Yeah. And for those of you listening who don't know about what GOG is up to, GOG announced a few months ago that they are going to start, or they have begun developing their own actual digital client, sort of similar to Steam, that you can use to download, play, and keep track of your games with, as opposed to what they do now, where it's all tied to the actual website. And at the time of this podcast, I believe it's still in beta, so it's not open to the public. I think there's some people who are using it now, but we don't have, you know, firsthand knowledge of that.
Yeah, so I think if GOG do it right, mm-hmm. theoretically they can make a better platform.
Yeah.
Whether or not they can make a competing platform is another question. Mm-hmm. I would love it to. I have great things to say about GOG and Humble as well. Mm-hmm. Outside of the way I upload games to their service, I don't like that.
Yeah.
But I know GOG are working on that. And mm-hmm. I've talked to Humble about that, and they're like, well, you know, we have problems, but whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe they do have plans and they just don't want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. But those, yeah, if they can make it better for developers and they can make it better for consumers, then I would happily switch over. There is this one downside, which is I'm sitting here looking at Steam mm-hmm. and my 600 games on it. And if I switch platforms, I have to use two platforms now.
Yeah. And that was actually the point I was just about to bring up, Nick, is that very issue. I mean, right now we have really four big sites. We have GOG, Steam, Uplay, and Origin. That's four different platforms with four different libraries. And as we were just saying, someone could compete with Steam from a product standpoint, but when you start having, you know, multiple digital clients, it's just going to bog down the consumer, and getting them to switch is going to be a monumental task. I mean, look how long it took people to finally get used to Steam. You know, what's the chance that someone who has 600-700 games on Steam is going to want to switch to your, you know, brand new digital platform?
Yep. It's kind of a really hard, that's the hardest problem, actually, because, mm-hmm. I mean, when it comes down to it, making a better service isn't that, is relatively not that hard,
mm-hmm.
compared to switching Steam's 80 million users. I mean, mm-hmm. actively, it's, what, 8 million a day?
Yeah.
But it's a lot of users. Switching even half of those or a quarter of those over is mm-hmm. quite the task, because there's no way Steam would give up or share licenses that you could see all games.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite an interesting discussion, because there's no solution in my mind to that problem, because it's a matter of a product's license and the fact that it can't be really transferred. Mm-hmm. Like, if you buy a license on Steam, it's owned by you, but it's sort of rented from Steam permanently.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they're beholden to whoever owns that license. Yeah. So they can't move it across. They would have to set up entirely new agreements with every single one of their clients,
mm-hmm.
which is absurd.
Yep. And the other major problem is for games that are fully Steam integrated. Stuff, as we said, with Screen Cheat, Payday 2, and any other game that makes use of, you know, Steam's functionality, like multiplayer, updating, metrics, stuff like that. If another client doesn't have that functionality built into it, your games sort of become attached to Steam. And there are developers, as we said a few minutes ago, regarding, you know, it's either Steam or bust for a lot of developers. So they basically design their games completely to be integrated with Steam. And in order to switch to another client require basically a completely reworking of their game, which is, you know, absolutely insane for, you know, an indie developer or really for any development house.
Yeah, like we've worked in such a way that we can create a DRM-free version of our game,
mm-hmm.
but you're actually losing functionality in the process of yeah. getting DRM-free. It automatically finds your name from Steam. It does achievements. Mm-hmm. Like, fortunately, we've also made that we actively knew we wanted to do DRM-free from the start, so we made sure we didn't tie too tightly into Steam.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's a lot of games out there that are, like, very heavily, like, some even use Steam servers for their networking
yeah.
solution, right? So that's just like, oh, so if I take it out of Steam, I don't have networking, and maybe I don't have achievements, I don't have automatic naming, and I don't have
mm-hmm.
Leaderboards. Friends can't join my game through their friends list anymore.
Uh-huh.
So you kind of shell this entire product, and it could create a couple of months of work just to transfer it over to another service.
Mm-hmm.
So whether or not developers will want to switch, like, you know, if GOG make the new platform and it's really good and I want to switch my game over, it's not too much work, but that's because we actively made the decision to mm-hmm. keep it thin, right?
Yeah.
A lot of developers don't do that.
Mm-hmm. And a good case in point of that would be sort of what happened with Dark Souls when it was
yep.
ported to the PC. And in its original form, it was attached to Games for Windows Live.
God.
And that's another lovely digital platform. We didn't bring that up earlier during our list because it's right now, I think it's either on life support or it is dead. I mean, I haven't heard anything new about since a year, 2 years ago.
I believe Microsoft officially said it's dead mm-hmm. and it's on life support, as you said, where it's they're slowly ripping all the cables out, which mm-hmm. would be each game that's integrated with it. And then yeah. once it's done, the game, it's officially being cut.
Yeah,
there's no integration with it in Windows 8 or anything, I don't think. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a platform that never even got off the ground in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, we could have, you know, like a 3-hour discussion just on all the follies of Games for Windows Live. And
that would be an example of a service that tried to clone Steam, did mm-hmm. it worse
yeah,
to a considerable amount,
mm-hmm.
and then forced you to use it in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
So you make a bad product, and then you force the user to use it. Then they don't like you for it, and mm-hmm. then you force it on the next game that you make, and they just don't buy that game, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's really not a good way to build customer faith. Like, at least the advantage is if you build a good product, customers are more likely to switch.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is, it's a lot of hurdles to jump just to fight with Steam.
Yeah, and that's a really good phrase right there, the hurdles to jump to get to another platform. It was, we've been talking about for the last 5-10 minutes, there's just so many hurdles for a new client to have to get across in order to compete with Steam. You got the users themselves, you have your games, you have simply the functionality that you're trying to compete with, and the giant market share that Steam has.
Yeah, it's like 95%, I think.
Yeah.
It's kind of absurd.
It's insane. And as we were saying, you know, it would be great to have competitors to Steam, to have legitimate other platforms. But at the same time, I really can't think of anyone who's in the position to step up and directly challenge Steam. We talked about GOG. They're probably the closest. But again, I don't know if they really have the market share and just the sheer clout to stand toe-to-toe with Steam.
Yeah, what you'd have to hope is that they build a product so fantastic
mm-hmm.
that the market share moves over to them because it's so good.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, I mean, like, consumers aren't that savvy.
Yeah.
They kind of get, once you get used to something, you kind of get used to its flaws.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes you a while to sort of switch over and be like, well, this is that, like, you use someone else's service. You're more likely to be upset by the differences
mm-hmm.
than happy with the positive changes.
Yeah.
That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
So you'll kind of, it'll just sort of gloss that over and you won't be like, oh, well, this is actually fundamentally better in so many ways
mm-hmm.
that it'll take you too long to switch.
Yeah. And as you were just saying, Nick, if your digital client sucks, it's going to also drive people away from your games. I mean, for me, I've seen games on Origin that look interesting, but I have no desire to reinstall that onto my system. And it's gotten to the point where if a game is on another client, I have to take a lot harder look at it to decide if I want to jump through those hoops to play it, as opposed to buying a game that I can buy, download, and play within minutes on Steam.
Yeah, like I'm not buying... I would like to play Dragon Age Inquisition, mm-hmm. But I can't because I somewhat, like, morally refuse to use Origin
mm-hmm.
and kind of just don't want to have another client and don't want to have another login account or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that's me as a consumer saying I just don't want to move over. Mm-hmm. That game I've heard is nothing but good things, but I don't want to do it. And I'm a big fan of the Origins. Oh, sorry, mm-hmm. Dragon Age Origins. But yeah. it's upsetting that it's that big an issue for me.
Yeah. For my example, it'll probably be the Anno series, and which started out as like Dawn of Discovery. Then we're up to Anno 2070 at the moment. By Blue Byte, they're really great, like management style city builder esque games, but they've been attached to Uplay now for like the last two iterations. I know The Settlers was as well, and I know people who just outright refuse to install Uplay. They may love those games, but their hatred of Uplay is stopping them from playing it and stopping these developers from getting the sales that they may need to stay afloat.
Yeah, it's actually kind of bad. Like, they're punishing a game, but not knowingly. I mean, Ubisoft have done lots of things for strange reasons and not known why, and then kind of openly said, we didn't, like, why did we do this thing? We didn't really know. And that's... And now that they've sort of committed to Uplay, that service is so integrated, they can't stop doing it. It's kind of like you're an alcoholic and you can't really stop, but you know you should.
Yeah.
It's just strange and really a shame. But that's a lot of the situation where you force a user to use a piece of software. For a long time, I think Steam wasn't a required thing, like, outside of Valve products, right? So PC gamers were still sort of edging their way in, but the problem that happened was... I think it's actually on that requirement level is Origin through EA and Uplay through Ubisoft, they would force you to use those platforms. Right. So you'd be like, oh, I want to get that game. I have to use it. It's not like, and they have a lot of games and they make, like, as opposed to Valve, who didn't make a lot of games, right? They just provided a good, they provided a good service which allowed you to purchase games, but there were always other ways to get them for a long time.
Yeah.
Now they kind of aren't, but it was far enough in that you were, you know, in that rabbit hole and you couldn't get out. Whereas Origin or Uplay would say, here's the new... And I think EA just totally took all their products off Steam altogether now.
Yeah. So it's... I believe if you already own the games, you can still play them. I believe Dragon Age 1 is still available on Steam as well as Mass Effect 1 and 2. But...
Yeah, I think I... Yeah, it's kind of like... I don't know how many consumers they've lost for that, but maybe it's just a way they can justify not playing PC games anymore because they kind of hate those platforms or seem to. It's really strange. But yeah, I'd love to, I'd actually personally love to see the numbers on what happened when they created that, like, say, look at Anno, whatever Anno version didn't have Steam, and whichever version of Anno did have Steam, because I know they have a lot of, Steam, Uplay, and just see how many sales they lost on PC because of that.
Yeah.
Because they forced users to use a service they didn't want to use, and there was no decision about it, and sometimes not even sort of upfront about it.
Yeah. And with Uplay, I still remember when it first came out and just the sheer backlash of the always online DRM, even for single player games.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that just killed a lot of their early PR for them. And again, I think Dawn of Discovery, when it came out, it was sort of right around that time. Oh, wait, my mistake. It was The Settlers that came out, Settlers 7, that came out just as Uplay was coming out. And I know they got, you know, caught in the crossfire for being part of Uplay. And again, with consumers, when your game is attached to that digital client, the digital client, the game sort of become, you know, interconnected that way.
Yeah, it's really strange the way that works.
Yeah.
Going back to Anno, I just looked at the Steam page. If you go to the system requirements, you have to see read more to see the fact that it says it requires a Uplay account to play. So they're actually obscuring that on a third-party platform. Which is great. Oh, there's actually requires a third-party agreement to ELUA, requires third-party DRM, Tages, three machine activation limit. Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's kind of rude.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not great.
And again, going back to jumping through hoops, when you have that annoyance of having to have not one digital client on, but two to play one game, it just becomes a huge pain in the ass. I know Dawn of War 2 did that, where you required Steam and Games Windows Live at the same time. And then you have that very good question of, why do I need two digital clients? Shouldn't one be enough?
Yeah, exactly. Like, let alone one. Like, why can't I have this game and maybe just run it and I purchased it through my client? Which is, to bring the point up, that is, I believe, what Good Old Games Galaxy is approaching it with. That the client is basically a desktop application, which is a good way to have a library of games. It is a way to purchase games, but it is not required to launch them. And I think that is their approach. And if that is their approach, that is fantastic.
Yeah. And
so it means you can have a library and not have the client running and just play your games.
Yeah. And that should really help, because I know I got like dozens of like GOG games like hidden all around my computer now from downloading them at various places and folders, and having it consolidated like that should really help them. But at the same time, as you said, Nick, it's not going to be required to play. If I just want to run it from the desktop menu, I can do that. Or I can use the Galaxy integration and its features to run it. But either way, the game is still, you know, 100% my control. And that's another, that right there is another hour-long topic right there in terms of digital ownership.
Yeah, it's really strange. I mean, this is the great thing about those other platforms like Humble and GOG is that they do push really hard for DRM-free. And, you know, it's like, DRM doesn't really do anything, let's be honest. We don't have any DRM on our game, and it's not hurting us. We don't have, like, a million people pirating it, because why would they?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's just, it's pushing for, like, sort of consumer rights, really. And where Steam doesn't do that, like, even though we don't have DRM, you can still use, when you launch the game through Steam, it's, even if you find it in the project, in your system files, it will launch with Steam. Like, it'll launch Steam as you launch it up, and that's just the nature of how it works.
All right. And since we've been talking about the game industry and just how it's evolved thanks to digital distribution, I have just a few more general questions for you, Nick, and then we will wrap things up.
Cool.
So one question that I would like to ask a lot of our guests is on the subject of crowdfunding and sort of the early access. We talked a little bit about Greenlight earlier, but I was just wondering if we could talk a little bit more just about your general thoughts and opinions on how crowdfunding has sort of become a very popular model for developers today.
Yeah, so like I've always been really interested in not Kickstarter or crowdfunding as much as early access, though I guess that early access I've always seen as a more explicit understanding of what crowdfunding is than Kickstarter, because I think it's a little bit better at explaining to the consumer what they're getting.
Yeah.
Because crowdfunding has this weird way of giving people entitlement and not telling them that you're actually pre-ordering a product that doesn't exist. Because that's what you're doing. When you, like, most games that are Kickstarted, the primary, like, Kickstart level is, you know, $15, you get the game early, and then you get to, you get maybe an alpha, and then you get it at release, right? And that's, I think that's essentially what early access is, except it doesn't tell you that, one, the product might never happen, and two, the product is going to be shit for a long time, and you're getting a rough thing, and you're actually doing work for the publisher, for the developer as well. Like, you, to some extent, the community is involved such that they also do QA for you, or an amount of QA. Not necessarily the best, but it's helpful. And I have a problem not with the model, but with the way the model is approached, where a developer isn't open, because you're by going into early access or doing a Kickstarter, you're explicitly opening yourself up to the consumer, so they get to see the development process. Yet you see so many developers look at early access as a way to get money during development and kind of make some patches and maybe get some free QA out of it, when the reality is what you have to do is open yourself up and keep the community in the loop at all times, giving them information, and to some extent also giving them some rights, because they expect it, and if you don't give them some rights, it's kind of rough on them, and it's kind of negative for you, because you'll just have this sort of upset community that, say, let's say you develop your game for a year, you have lots of consistent updates, and your community gives all this feedback, and yet they never see that feedback effectively used or applied, even if it's good or bad feedback, as in, like, you know, shit idea versus good idea. If they don't see something out of that, they're going to get really disenfranchised and not really respect the developer's use of that way of development. But I think the most important bit is communication. And you know, we saw failures of this, like recently, Towns, Space Base 9, just developers not respecting their customers and their consumers enough.
That communication is just a huge deal. And it's really one of the big parts I see a lot of indie developers tend to slip up on, is that they go into the, you know, this like hibernation mode where they don't respond to the own update anymore for months on end, and it can really just come back to bite them.
And, yeah, exactly.
Yep. And as a good example of, you know, positive of this, it would be the developers of Lambeer with Nuclear Throne. I've been following them since I got my free copy, and they've been committing to weekly updates. They have two live stream events each week. They're constantly keeping the community informed about what's going on, what they're working on. And as you said, Nick, having that rapport with your community is required in order to get the most out of early access, because you're not developing your game in a bubble anymore. It's technically out there and being sold. Even though, you know, it still has months and months of development, it's still a product on Steam's website or the Steam interface.
Yeah, it's like, and then you have, you're also committing to a large amount of work, and there is this weird thing where games can go on early access, and there is actually a, I think there's a clause now that like says this game might never get released.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something the community would never understand.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, some games just have gone into like sleep on early access, but the developer's gone silent and they've actually abandoned the project. Mm-hmm. And then you're just kind of left with this, you know, shell of a game. It's really, really bad.
Yeah.
But that's the, obviously, the most extreme end of it. The sort of lesser extreme is more just a developer who just sort of goes quiet, updates infrequently, and generally doesn't listen to their community.
Yeah. And then what happens there is that if, you know, one game pisses the consumer off, what's its chance that they're going to support another developer's early access? Because we see a lot of consumers, you know, say, I want to buy your game, but because on early access, I'm not going to touch it because I got screwed, you know, with this guy 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. So we actually did something really weird with our game when we released it. We released on October, but before that, we did a full month of beta.
Mm-hmm.
So we had an open beta on Steam. People could get access to it through our website, and they could get keys, and they could play the game for free for a month. And it had a limited amount of content, and the idea was just to stress test the networks to get a vibe from the community and to also build up some, you know, positive buzz. And the result was that we basically got some of that value that you would get out of early access, but we got none of the negatives that come with the long term of, say, someone buying the game and saying, oh, well, this was in early access, or it was, you know, it's like, well, I don't want to give this a go because it's early access, not finished yet. Like, when you say beta, it sort of implies a state. But, like, early access games tend to not really explain to the consumer where the state of the game is, effectively. Yeah. Especially not to a current consumer, but to a new one. So if someone's coming in, they're looking at the Steam page, and they go, this game's in early access, but from the Steam page, do I know where it is? Like,
exactly.
Is it 10% away from being finished? You know, like, is it just needing some polish? Or is it, like, 10% done? Is it just a prototype at this point?
Yeah, exactly. So, there's no standardization to early access at the moment. You know, one guy can put his game on, as you said, it could be beta, you know, we just need to finish the art and it's done. Or it could be 0.001 alpha, we just finished a prototype last week and we uploaded it to Steam.
Yeah, like, I feel like that would be actually a fantastic feature for early access games on Steam, where next to that big early access banner, it has, you know, just straightforward development stuff, right? Like, it has, like, you can choose to set your game into three states or four states, you know, like prototype, alpha, beta, and release, right? Yeah. And it just gives the consumer something so they know where the game's at.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it has, like, below that little tiny log of when those other milestones were hit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, launched in prototype, hit alpha here, released here, and you kind of get a rough timeline that way as well. You're like, well, if I'm buying it now, it's probably going to be done in 6 months. And theoretically, the developer's got nice blog posts, and they're explaining, you know, how things are going, and they're like, okay, well, this is actively being developed. It's at this point. It's going to be finished this time. So if I'm buying it now, I'm probably going to get a pretty good experience out of it.
Yeah. And one last question regarding crowdfunding, and then we'll move on to my final question. And in terms of crowdfunding, and just in general, this is another one of those questions I like to ask all the developers who come on. And I just want to get your opinion on, what do you think about crowdfunding from a sustainability standpoint? Do you think that it will remain viable for developers in the future? Or do you think that certain things may have to change for it to happen?
I think it's becoming viable in a different way to what it was before. So you may have noticed, we haven't heard about these. You remember, like, the Double Fine Kickstarter, remember Star Citizen. We haven't heard about anything like that in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
The reason is consumers have understood what the state of crowdfunding is, what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're getting these sort of like small projects that understand what they are. Like, I think crowdfunding has its place in sort of helping, you know, a developer get the last leg of its project finished, or get some, like, it's just like We just need this little bit to push us over. It's not, you know, we have this idea and we want to make it. It's going to cost us $2 million. It's like, oh, we're you know, 6 months down the line, the game's taking 3 months longer than we thought.
Mm-hmm.
And we need that. We need 10 grand to finish it off. And on top of that, the consumers are starting to understand that that's the point, right? Crowdfunding is you are investing in a product, and as such, you get a product in return,
mm-hmm.
right? If it gets finished, and people are a little bit more aware that that's a possibility that something can fail. And sure, we're seeing less uptake on Kickstarters,
mm-hmm.
but we're seeing smaller ones and more realistic ones happen. I think it's a little bit more of, it's no more or less sustainable than it was before. It's more that the realities of what Kickstarter's place in the world is has sort of become a bit more clear, which mm-hmm. is good because when you go into it, you know what you're getting and you know what other people think you're getting. Mm-hmm. But down the line, there's still ways to go, right? It's still a couple of years new
mm-hmm.
to the general consumer, and it has yet to really hit the mass market as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the point of crowdfunding is to supply to the niche to some extent, but there's always that mass appeal that could be reached, you know,
yeah.
the next... So it's yet what do you have to see if like weirder but more mass appeal products get sort of kickstarted, and whether or not that will actually work, what happens. So it's interesting, but it has a place, I think, and I'd love to see it continue. It's not something we're looking at personally, but
mm-hmm.
I think it's still interesting.
All right. So I think with that, I have one final question for you, Nick, just regarding game design. And this sort of goes back to what we've been talking about in the cast with how the industry has sort of evolved. We've talked about how it went from local multiplayer to where we are now at with digital clients. And we've also talked a little bit about how first-person shooter design has evolved and changed as well. So my last question for you, Nick, I just want to get your opinion on this, is what is your thoughts on sort of the extrinsic rewards that have started to appear in game design, stuff like Steam achievements, trading cards, hats, stuff like that, that have sort of really become a staple of digital games today, where before, you know, games were pretty much limited to whatever rewards were in-game. You know, there's no, you know, tied accounts, there's no achievement pages, stuff like that.
Yeah, I think... It's essentially, it sort of serves two purposes. I mean, each little achievement or little thing has its own purpose, but I mean, it sort of fills a gap in games that don't have a lot of content,
mm-hmm.
or games that have content, but it's not very interesting, and it can do double duty to, like, make a bad game, give you a reason mm-hmm. to finish a bad game, or in some ways, provide you incentive to continue playing a game that maybe is good, but you haven't got there. And it's strange how it can sort of like make bad games slightly worse because you like play through them and then like you finish them, and you're like, oh, I got the achievement, but that game was a piece of shit. Or you play through a game for half an hour and you're like, oh, it's not great, but like maybe I'll play for a little bit more because I'll get a Steam trading card drop or something, right? Like, because
mm-hmm.
some people care. And then, you know, you play for 45 minutes more and you get just far enough for you to sort of, for the game to click,
mm-hmm.
right? So there are positives and negatives. It's a really strange one because it comes down to like what each player likes. Like I know some people don't care about specific things, and it's weird that like I used to play a lot on Xbox 360, and now I play all my games on PC,
mm-hmm.
and I don't like achievements on Steam, but I really like them back on Xbox.
Mm-hmm.
And was that because they had a number attached to them? I don't know. It's strange how they can sort of like pull you into playing a game for longer. I played a lot more Perfect Dark Zero than I should have because it had achievements and I wanted to get all of them and I couldn't because that game is impossible. So, yeah. But there's so many examples of places where I've seen it be used really effectively. A really obscure example is Test Drive Unlimited 1. If you unlocked it, it linked progression in the game to achievements in such a way that achievements were basically the way of dictating how far you were in the game.
Mm-hmm.
So certain achievements would sort of give you like a milestone, and if you unlock the achievement, you would unlock experience, which would push you slightly further up the ranking, and the ranking determined other gameplay stuff, like which cars you could buy or where mm-hmm. you could go on the island, I think. I'm not sure. It's been a while. But it was interesting how they actually like took it beyond just being like a surface level unlock to being a mechanical unlock, which was really cool.
Yeah.
And I would love to see more of that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like it has positives, and it has the negatives are only making shit games sort of shitter.
Mm-hmm.
So it's it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say my best example would be sort of what they did with The Binding of Isaac and how they tie the achievements to the progression model. Sort of similar to what you were just saying with Test Drive, with how in Isaac, every achievement corresponded to a new unlock to the randomization of each game.
Yeah, I think Risk of Rain does the same thing. Mm-hmm. Roguelikes, yeah, you know, there's a couple of roguelikes actually now that I think about it, how I do all that. And it's cool because it gives you sort of a direction in a game that is kind of arguably directionless.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of meta, and you can compare it with your friends, so it kind of gives you sort of like a two-leveled, like, well, look at this achievement I've got. Oh, so you've made it this far in the game. Cool, that's awesome. Yeah, it's interesting how different games are approaching it.
Yeah.
It's actually very cool that it is being still done effectively, and I'd love to see more of it done effectively.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And again, that's another great springboard topic. We could spend another hour or so talking about that. And we should definitely have you back on at some point and talk more about roguelike design, because that's another topic that I love talking about, as there's just so much variety in that genre now, and how it has really, as we said, exploded in popularity with like roguelites that have made it a lot easier for someone to get into it, as opposed to the old school, you know, NetHack and Rogue.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a really interesting genre. I mean, I've made the joke that it's the new indie retro indie platformer, whereas... And now, I mean, there's the space game is also the big new thing as well. The sort of like open world space games. But I mean, I think it has legs beyond just being a genre because it's kind of like how shooters started taking RPG elements into account.
Yeah.
Whereas you're seeing lots of genres take roguelike elements into account because it actually can provide a lot of value for not minimal work, but an amount of work. It can provide more work than it is. More value than it is work, which is great because it extends the lifespan of something. It gives players something to aim for, something to shoot for, and it sort of can provide variety in interesting ways and just open up the door to more interesting designs.
Definitely. And I think with that, that is a good point to end on. Again, I know we've brought up so many great topics that we could spend the next few hours on.
Yeah.
But I think with that, I just have a few last questions and then we will end things. So I guess... For you, Nick, and Samurai Punk, can you say anything about what you guys are working on next following Screen Sheet, or is that still in the works?
Yeah, it's mostly still in the works. We do have plan to have something by sort of middle of the year, sort of announced at that point. We've got a lot of content still to do for Screen Sheet, and we're looking at other platforms we can get onto. But outside of that, we really want to move on to something interesting and exciting, and we're keen to get working on something good as well. So, yeah, that's as much as I can say.
Awesome. All right. And with that, my last question for you, Nick, is do you have any final thoughts or anything you would like to say to the fans listening?
Well, if anyone's played Screen Sheet, I'd like to say thank you very much for playing Screen Sheet. It's been great having sort of a community grow up about it. And if anyone has it, they should go check it out because it's not that bad. I think it's pretty fun. And if they're interested in following us on any of the social media platforms, we are Samurai Punk on Twitch. We're Samurai Punk Co. on Twitter. And you can follow me at NicholasMC1 on Twitter. That's about it.
Awesome. All right. So I think with that, we're going to wrap things up. Nick, it was definitely a pleasure talking to you tonight. And Screen Sheet is very interesting. And I do wish you guys the best of luck with whatever your next project is.
Okay. Thank you so much.
So with that said, we're going to end things for the Perceptive Podcast. Thank you for tuning in. And as always, if you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, we have several options available. If you would like to be a future podcast guest or write a guest piece for the site, you can find all the information and links to that under Submissions Wanted. And as I said before, we are continuing to look for new developers for our roundtable discussions into 2015. So if you are a game developer who would like to come on, definitely shoot me an email and I can add you to the list of applicants. And for those of you who like to contribute to Game Wisdom's ongoing funding campaign through Patreon, you can find that under our Patreon banner also on the front page. So, thanks again for listening to the Perceptive Podcast. Have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.